Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. Increasing numbers of Americans are choosing to make their homes in or near wildlands, and that's not difficult to understand. Can be very appealing, the notion of living in a place surrounded by big stands of mature trees, or maybe what you'd like to do is live by a lake, or you'd like to live by the ocean. However, this kind of movement does pose some serious threats for the environment. This area where houses come together with undeveloped land is called by ecologists the wildland-urban interface. That's the technical term, and it is an important focal area for conflicts between people and the environment. It's been estimated, for example, that more than half of all endangered species in the United States are in peril due to urbanization. Housing development in wild areas can also lead to habitat loss and also habitat fragmentation. This morning in this part of Focus, we'll talk a little bit about the wildland-urban interface in this country and some of the problems that result. And our guest for the program is Volker Radloff. He is assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in the Department of Forest Ecology and Management. And this is a subject that he has studied and written on, and we're pleased that he can be with us. He's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are welcome. 333-9455 is the number if you are living here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are. It would be a local call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That means no matter where you're listening, if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. We'll pay for the call, 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is people just try to be brief so that we can keep things moving along. But anyone who is interested in calling, joining the conversation, may do that. Professor Radloff, hello.
Hi.
Well, thanks for talking with us.
Hi, David. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
We appreciate it. Let's talk a little bit more. Just give us a bit more of a definition of the of what it is we're talking about here. What qualifies as wildland-urban interface?
Yeah, the way we define the wildland-urban interface is that it's any area where we have more than one house per 40 acres, and it's an area that either has wildland vegetation, so forests or shrublands or native grasses, or so right intermixed between the houses, or it's an area that's within a mile and a half of a big contiguous forest. Mm-hmm. So wildland-urban interface, more than one house per 40 acres and close or within wildland vegetation.
And now how many places in the United States, or perhaps I know that you can talk about it, for example, in percentage terms. Maybe you can also talk about it in terms of acreage, but
yeah,
put some numbers to that to talk about, well, how much territory is there in the wildland urban interface in the United States?
Yeah, we've taken a close look at the lower 48, and in the lower 48, about 10%, so 1 acre out of 10 is in the wildland-urban interface, so that's almost 178 million acres, so a huge land area. And even more striking is that when we look at all the houses, that 44 million housing units out of the 150 million are in the wildland-urban interface, so that's 40%. So it's an area where a lot of people like to live in, and I surely don't blame them. I mean, I think it's a place, as you said in your introduction, that's very attractive to be. On one end, close to urban amenities, on another side, close to wild areas, to open space.
Yeah, so that we're really talking about a significant amount of territory, and then also if you must factor in the interest of the people who live there, so you're looking also at a significant number of people and a significant number of homes.
Yeah. No, the area is large, and it's really spread in hot spots throughout the entire U.S. It's very prevalent, for instance, in Southern California. We see large areas in the Colorado foothills and in the Front Range there around Denver. We see Southern Florida, large woody areas, and along the East Coast, the Northeastern Seaboard, Southern Appalachia. And in our neck of the woods, the North Woods of Michigan, Wisconsin and Minnesota have quite a bit, so do the Ozarks in Missouri, and as well areas in southern Illinois, southern Indiana, in the Hoosier and the Shawnee National Forest have a lot of wildland-urban interface.
Yeah, and that helps to make the point that we are also talking about a lot of territory, and we're also talking about different kinds of ecosystems being affected. So maybe you might think about someone who would really like to live in the forest and build a home there. We're talking about that too. But also, for example, within probably the last few decades, we've seen significant numbers of people moving to coastal areas of the United States because, as I said, you know, some people say, well, what I'd like to do is live near the ocean, and I can understand that. But we're talking about that kind of thing too. So it's happening in a lot of different places and affecting different kinds of ecosystems, not just, for example, forest and forested areas.
Yes, that point is absolutely true. It's correct. For instance, in Southern California, a lot of the wildland-urban interface is in shrubby vegetation that's called chaparral that burns very well. So that's where some of the fire problems have become so prevalent. And, of course, the recent tragic accidents there have brought that to the attention of many people.
Well, and that's really, I think that's what it is that started us thinking about talking about this, about looking at the coverage of the recent fires in California and taking note of the fact that there were significant numbers of people who had houses in this area. So it was complicated by the fact that we had obviously concerns about trying to control those fires, but also concerns about trying to protect people's lives and people's property that was located in these areas.
Correct. And these areas, when we put a lot of houses in an area, what we see is a pattern where we get more fires partially due to the houses because a lot of the fires are caused by people either accidentally or in extreme cases by arson. But in Southern California, 95% of all the fires are human caused. When we look at the whole United States, about 80% are human caused, and about half of all the acres that burn due to human-caused fires. And so as we have more houses in the wildland-urban interface, we have more people, a cigarette butt that starts a fire or a grill topples over or things like that, and that creates more fire. And at the same time, as you pointed out, it becomes much harder to fight fire because the stakes are much higher when homes are at risk or even lives are at risk. And it becomes harder for firefighters. Their options are much more limited in these areas.
So, and I'm also guessing that you said that 10% of the 10% of the land in the United States falls within the wildlife urban interface. 44 million homes. I'm guessing that also the numbers of people living in these areas has significantly increased. I'm guessing, say since the last 50 years, since the end in the post-war period, that the numbers have really gone up.
The numbers have certainly gone up, and on average, you can say a household is about 2.5 people. So, multiplying that, the reason we track houses and not people is that people move; they have a different workplace and things like that. So, houses have a very strong footprint locally, and they're easier to keep track over time. But yes, you're right, the number of people has increased. And just in the last decade, in the 1990s, there have 13.6 million new housing units were built across the United States, and 2 out of 3 of these are in the wildland-urban interface. So the problem is not going to go away anytime soon.
Let me just very quickly introduce again the guest for this hour. We're talking with Volker Radloff. He is assistant professor in the Department of Forest Ecology and Management at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's particularly interested in his research in landscape ecology, and we're talking about some of the implications of this increase in the numbers of people who have chosen to live in or near wild areas, this kind of place that ecologists call the wildland-urban interface in the United States. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, I want to get in and give you the opportunity to talk a little bit about just what kind of impacts this has on wild areas, and I guess I could imagine some people would say, well, let us say for an example, for a case study, we have a wooded area and somebody says, well, I would like to live in there. So they come along and they clear out a space and they build a house. I'm sure that some people would say, well, really, how much could one house, one family, a couple of people clearing off even as much as an acre, how in the middle of what is the rest stays undeveloped, how could that really make much of a difference?
Good question. And I think two points are important to note here. First is that when we put a house in a big forested area, the effect of that house extends far beyond that acre or however large the area that is immediately cleared. And why these effects extend further is that we have many wildlife species, for instance, that are very sensitive to human disturbance. So if they hear noise or so, they will stay away from that. The second reason is that we have, as we clear that acre, we have an increase, what we call a forest edge. And that is advantageous to some species, like white-tailed deer, for instance, or also advantageous to a lot of invasive species. So non-native species that came from abroad that are introduced sometimes through landscaping and that will spread then from that house into the surrounding forest. And we have many bird species that require large contiguous forests as their habitat, and we call them interior forest bird species. The cerulean warbler is one example, a beautiful little bluebird. And these species, if the forest starts to be fragmented, if there are holes in the forest canopy, they disappear. They just say, yeah, this is no longer my habitat. And that happens in the forested area at a much larger zone around the actual house, around the actual footprint of the house itself. The other thing that's important is, well, you don't have only the house, you also have a road that will lead to the house. And we've done some work in northern Wisconsin and seen that over the last 50 years, the number and the length of roads more than doubled in that area. And with roads, again, we have the fragmentation of the forest, we have areas where invasive species can come, and we have increasing human presence and disturbance, and a lot of wildlife species will respond negatively to that.
And I'm sure that is the case that when we're talking about the kinds of development that we are talking about, it's not the case where you have some large area and you just have one house. That kind of area is going to be attractive to more than just one person. And even if you build the houses and situate them so that you can't see your neighbors, even if you have people relatively close by and you have enough of them, what happens is that's an even that sort of adds to the weight of the kind of fragmentation that you're talking about that can disturb the natural patterns of animal life, particularly even if these houses are not clustered. In fact, I think that's probably true, that it might actually even be better if the houses were clustered.
Yes, and that's one of the solutions that we advocate, that we talk about, is that there houses will continue to be built. Or so, but if we have a large area, let's of 200 acres of forest, and we say we want to put 10 houses in there, one alternative is to say, okay, everybody gets a 20-acre lot, and another alternative is to say, let's cluster the houses in one corner and leave the rest untouched. And from our work and what we can see, it is much better to cluster the development in certain areas and then leave other areas more or less untouched because of these effects that extend further away from the houses.
And I suppose, though, that's difficult from I'm sure that there are ways that you can handle that, but that might be a little difficult from a development perspective because, in fact, what people want is they want at least the illusion of being out there by themselves. They don't want to come out their front door and see their neighbors. They'd rather just look at trees.
Correct, but I think everyone has the hope that, well, I built my house and I will be the last one who's ever going to build a house in that area. And what happens in a way is I think, very tragic, that people seek out wild areas. They seek out open spaces. They love these places. But then as they do it, so do many other people, and all of a sudden we reach development densities where, yeah, the wildlife species they were interested in no longer can live there. And so the negative effects then come to haunt them. And that's, I think, where what we need is a discussion simply what in different areas of the country, what we want landscapes to look like and how we can accomplish both, that we maintain open spaces, maintain wild areas, and at the same time give people attractive places to live.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I learned in looking at some of the material on this, I was a little surprised, and perhaps I shouldn't have been surprised, but I was a little bit surprised at how much privately held land there is within the boundaries of national forests.
Correct.
And that perhaps the issue is that people have owned that land for a long time prior to the fact that it was a national forest, and so you have to respect their property rights, but that also makes it perhaps more difficult to implement policy if you have within some large publicly owned land, you have pockets of privately held land.
That makes it very complicated, and the Forest Service regards the loss of open space as one of the four major threats facing the nation's forest right now. And just some numbers here from Illinois and Indiana. In the Shawnee National Forest in southern Illinois, 62%, so almost two-thirds of the land that looks like a nice green big block on a highway map or so, 62% are privately owned. In the Hoosier National Forest in southern Indiana, it's even 69%, so more than two-thirds of the area are privately owned. And the reason is that in the Midwest, the settlement occurred before national forests were established in the early 1900s, so all land was privately owned at one point, and then it reverted to public ownership. But that's a patchy process, and a lot of people held onto their land, especially in northern Wisconsin. If its property is near to a lake, people are not very likely to sell those to the national forest. But for a forest manager, that makes it very hard, and from a conservation standpoint, too, because all of these little inholdings are likely to be developed.
Mm. You talked about the fact that having people living in these kinds of areas that were and may still be partially wild disturbs the wildlife. It breaks up and perhaps causes changes in the environment that certain species depend on. That can be one issue. Changing the environment to the extent that it gives an advantage to species that are in a sense introduced, mm-hmm. Because they wouldn't normally have been living there. But what we've done is we've disturbed the environment to the extent that it now creates a niche that they can take advantage of that they wouldn't have before. Another thing that I was really kind of surprised by, and I mentioned it just in the beginning, was that more than half of all of the federally listed threatened and endangered species in this country are endangered because of urbanization.
Correct. And the reasons for that is, I mean, it's that 10% of the land area, it's not just randomly scattered throughout the country. It's heavily focused in some areas like coastal California, for instance, where we have a lot of species that are what we call endemic, that occur only in those areas. So when I start to destroy their habitat, those populations are very quickly lost. But these development patterns are happening throughout the countries, and that is why it's putting so many species at risk. And we've done an analysis not only on these listed threatened and endangered species, but with my collaborator, Anna Pidgeon, looked at bird populations in general, and over the last two, three decades, examine how much do houses affect bird populations. And what we see is that with every decade, the effects of houses on bird populations are getting stronger and stronger. So this trend is likely to continue, and especially with the baby boomers reaching retirement age now, there's a large cohort that will look for their little piece of paradise in retirement.
Yeah, and I suppose it's something that maybe escapes people's notice because they look around them and they say, well, I see birds, I see lots of birds, and the fact is that what happens is that those animals that we are going to see more of and that will be successful in urban environments are those that adapt most easily to living around people.
Yeah.
And that the other species that really are used to living in places where they're not, where they have certain specific kinds of environments, they need certain amounts of land for each, say, for each breeding pair, you've got to have so much territory, and that those animals just, they're not comfortable being around people. They disturb the environment, so they're going to go someplace else, or maybe they're going to disappear, and that perhaps then other birds are going to come and take their place in terms of numbers, but they will be those birds that can, they have no problem being around people. So if you look at the total numbers, you might say, well, gee, they look like plenty of birds to me, but if you look at the issue of species diversity, there's where you're really going to see the impact.
Yeah, you put it very well. And I spoke with a cabin owner in northern Wisconsin, and he had his cabin for 50 years. And he said the first 20, 30 years or so that he was up there, he's never seen a robin. It just did not exist. But then more and more people started building cabins, having a little lawn, and the footprint of each cabin is not very large. But if you have dozens of them around a lake, all of a sudden there was enough habitat there, as you said, for robins. I mean, those species that are ubiquitous anyhow, they can colonize these areas. At the same time, species like loons that need vegetation close to the shore that's undisturbed to breed, they are having trouble. The rarer species are the ones that are falling out.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose also what happens with the disturbance of the environment, and that can be caused by people moving into it, is that you also then start to have, you give an advantage to some things that are going to be there anyway, but because of their numbers might might turn into nuisance species in a sense. And there, I suppose, the thing that I'm thinking of, the number one thing I think of is the white-tailed deer, which, in fact, probably because of what we've done to the environment and also because actually because of efforts to try to protect these animals and also perhaps because we don't have as many people hunting as we used to, all sorts of things have gone together so that there are a number of places where they have tremendous problems with too many of them.
Correct. No, the wild-tailed deer populations have exploded. And the wildland-urban interface is a very hard place to hunt because deer are very adaptive. They learn quickly. And if they learn, hey, these gardens, we can stand all hunting season and never get shot at, that's where they will be. And at the same time, as a hunter, I don't want to be close to houses. It's too dangerous. The likelihood of an accident is too high. So these areas have, on one hand, enough forage for deer so that they can live there all year long. And at the same time, hunting is not a viable management tool anymore, and that's where deer populations have exploded. But in general, deer populations have increased quite a bit. And white-tailed deer are an edge species, so they are one of the species that benefit from a more fragmented landscape.
And another thing, I suppose, that is a kind of a problem, but again, it's a problem because we're moving into areas where the animals are used to living, is this the sometimes increasing problematic interaction between people and wild animals. And there I'm thinking about things like bear.
Yep.
and big cats, things like that, where people talk about looking out at their back door and seeing wild animals, difficult, big, potentially dangerous wild animals in their backyard and saying, hey, I got a problem. I have a bear in my yard. Well, I suppose some people might turn that around and say, well, actually, you're in the bear's yard.
Yeah.
The bear was there first, and you moved there. So that's, you shouldn't be surprised that increasingly there might indeed be conflict between people and, you know, maybe deer aren't exactly a problem, but bear might be a problem with interactions between the animals that are there normally and the people that have now come into a place where there really weren't people before.
Yeah, no, that is a good point. Mountain lion is another issue, especially in the western United States, where if you go in the parks of Boulder or so, you see the warning signs there if you jog to be careful with mountain lions. But, of course, if an accident happens, ultimately the animal is always the one that's going to get shot. So the pressure on these large carnivores is going to increase as more houses are built.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Volker Radloff, is assistant professor in the Department of Forest Ecology and Management at University of Wisconsin-Madison. We are talking about the wildland-urban interface in the United States. That's the term that ecologists have for areas where there are houses that either come up against or maybe they're mixed up with undeveloped wild lands. And it is something that we have seen more and more in the last few decades. More and more people are choosing to live in and near wild areas. Those areas have obvious appeal. So, as we said, it's not surprising that someone won't want to live in the forest or by a nice lake or at the ocean's edge. But that does create some issues for environment, and that's what we're talking about here. We have several people here who will talk with us, join the conversation, and questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have first caller here from Bloomington, Illinois, on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This issue sounds a lot like the main issue of urban sprawl and the general auto-centered development that's going on in the United States, economic development basically based on the vehicle and roads being subsidized to help that. But some of the solutions to that that I'm aware of are mixed-use zoning laws, the principles of new urbanism, greater access, and just more mass transit for people to stay in urban centers as well as to reduce the need for more roads. I'd just like to hear your guest comment on what kind of solutions he thinks would be relevant to this, and I'll take my question off air. Thank you.
All right.
Thanks. That's a very good question. I think, an important one. And I think there are solutions at three levels. And what your guest spoke about is different types of zonings. And that's what is mostly done at the township or the county level. And he's absolutely right. There's a lot we can do with mixed-use zoning, smart growth initiatives, similar things to say, okay, these are areas where we want development to occur, and these other areas we want to keep free of development. So that's one issue, and cluster development is something that with these zoning laws can really be pushed quite nicely. At another level, I think also individual homeowners have a lot of opportunities to minimize the impact of their house because, well, once I have a house in the woods, what do I do? I'm not going to burn it down and plant trees or so. But things to keep in mind is, first of all, when I have pets like cats or dogs or so, they can take a very heavy toll on bird communities. And so with cats, if I can keep them indoor or if I can build a screen enclosure for them, especially during the breeding season early in spring, that can help a lot. Same with dogs, not letting them run wild early in the spring or during the breeding season can help a lot to minimize the effects of development on birds. As a landowner, in terms of landscaping, it is much advantageous to use native species rather than foreign species or exotic species because that reduces the risks that these species will spread into the surrounding area. If I have a little woodlot or so, leaving some dead trees can have a huge impact on wildlife population, on woodpeckers, on species that nest in cavities. So leaving a snag or leaving some dead wood on the ground can help quite a bit. And if I'm in the lucky position to have a slightly larger piece of property, then I think it would be great to consider a conservation easement. So talking with a local land trust or groups like the Nature Conservancy, who are often interested to purchase the right to development or to receive a donation of the right to development, and that can then be used to save some taxes. So homeowners can do a lot, townships and counties can do a lot, and people getting active in their zoning commissions and so forth will help a lot. And last but not least, there are federal policies that affect our development patterns. Highway subsidies, the way we tax real estate sales, all these things affect how land use decisions are made on the ground. And what I think we need is more of a discussion, as I said, how we want America to look in the future and then to develop federal policies that foster the kind of development that's more sustainable.
Yeah, I think I'm really glad the caller raised the question because we had been spending a lot of our time talking about the problem and not really talking about so much about the solution. And I think that we have to acknowledge the fact that, well, there might be some areas where we would say this area is going to be off limits to develop forever. That's it. Full stop. End of conversation. But that there will be other areas where we can't say that, and we're simply not going to be able to tell people who want to build a house in a certain place. We're just not going to be able to tell them, no, sorry, you can't.
Yeah.
There has to be some way to try to satisfy their desire and also minimize the impact on the environment.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree more, yeah.
Let's talk with someone here in Indiana, Oaktown, Indiana. This is line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Would you care to explain to me what a classified forest is? Hello?
Hello.
Did you hear the caller?
I understand the question, what a classified forest is.
What a classified forest is, yes.
I may have used some jargon here, and I apologize. The way we assess where forests are is using satellite images, and we process them using a process called classification, so that identifies forested areas.
Well,
so I apologize if that was confusing. This has nothing to do with national security or anything.
No. Here in my county, I know there's within 15 miles of my house are classified forests, and they have signs put up, they're classified forests. And I was wondering if you knew what those were.
I'm not familiar with that.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay, thank you for your time.
All right, well, let's go on to another caller here. This is back where we are in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Has anyone, by that I mean, has, for instance, a county government to manage development at the forest edge, tried to restrict a development by refusing to extend municipal water mains? Or has anyone ever asked, for instance, the state of Wisconsin not to issue permits to drill water wells by state licensed drillers in Wisconsin to restrict development in that area, in that manner, I should say?
Yeah, you bring up a very good point, and the access to water is one of the major factors that affect development patterns. I'm not sure if anyone has asked the state of Wisconsin, but I do know that within my own home county or so, the question of how far to extend the water mains is very actively discussed. partially to limit development, also partially because it is very expensive if you have houses scattered and each of them gets their own water pipe. If houses are clustered, it is much easier to service them. When we look at development patterns across the United States, we see a lot of development in our neck of the woods and in the eastern U.S. because it is fairly easy to drill a well and to get water in many locations. In the western United States, limits of where water is accessible have somewhat constrained where growth in the wildland-urban interface can occur.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Again, our guest in this hour is Volker Radloff. He is assistant professor in the Department of Forest Ecology and Management at University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we're talking about this trend that we have seen more and more in recent decades of people choosing to live in or near wild areas and what that means for the environment. You have questions, comments, you can give us a call. One of our earlier callers here mentioned the word sprawl, and I'm wondering to what extent, in one sense, people might be thinking what we're talking about is sort of isolated, large isolated wild areas, and one individual or maybe a few individuals going out there and deciding here's a place, it's really kind of like out in the middle of nowhere, that's what I want, I'm going to build a house here. In what sense, though, is what we're talking about urban areas that are expanding and, say, expanding into or expanding right up against wild areas that happen to be adjacent to existing large urban areas, so that it isn't an issue of sprawl that we're talking about?
It is an issue of sprawl, and we've said there are basically two types of sprawl. One is urban sprawl, and that's development at the urban fringe, and like Los Angeles or Atlanta, those are cities that have grown very rapidly at their fringe. So that's quite prevalent. And a lot of them are abutting now national forests and other wildlands. The other issue is the rural sprawl in areas like in the Ozarks or northern Wisconsin or the northern half of the lower peninsula of Michigan. We see a lot of housing development and a lot of wildland-urban interface without any sizable urban center in the middle, so to speak. That's just development that occurs because these areas are very rich in their amenities.
Mm-hmm. So in both cases, that is something that that planners who work in those areas should be, and I'm sure that they do, they think about it and they do try to address in under this general heading of concern about the issue of sprawl.
Yes, no, and planners are thinking about that very actively, and things like cluster development, that's not something that I have invented, so that is something that planners think about. Also, land management agencies, and we work very closely with the Forest Service, especially the Northern Research Station in one of their units in Evanston, Illinois. So these agencies are quite aware of that and are thinking about good solutions, good planning solutions, too. I'd like to share a little anecdote, though, because when we speak about zoning, usually the first reaction is, well, someone is taking away my rights as a landowner or so, and that's an issue to be addressed. But I was at a conference last year and spoke with people from the Dutch Ministry of Agriculture, and they told me that the Netherlands will set aside one-fifth of their country, 20%, by 2020 in protected areas, wildlands. And I was totally surprised. My chin dropped, and I thought the Netherlands is, of all the bigger countries or so, the one with the highest human population density. How can they set aside 20% of their land? And how, I mean, sure, there are always environmentalists who would like to see that, but what arguments were used? And they said the major argument was that our societies, our industries are moving more and more towards information societies. And people working in that, they can live anywhere. And the argument that the people from the Netherlands made is that they said, we want to be sure that we have landscapes that people want to live in the future, and that will ensure our economic growth. So as we talk about the future of landscapes in the United States, I think it's important to keep in mind that if we develop too much, if land areas are no longer attractive to live in or so, we are also losing out in the long run.
Yeah. Well, that certainly would suggest that the kind of issues that we're talking about here don't just apply to the United States. I'm sure that they apply to a lot of other places as well. How when the government took that decision, how was that greeted? Do you know how that was greeted by people in the Netherlands? Did generally people support that, or was that at all controversial?
It was true controversial with individual landowners for whom some compensations had to be found and so forth. But in general, people very much supported it because for most people, that means they have more places where they can take a stroll on the weekend and they have richer landscapes, healthier landscapes, more opportunities to watch wildlife and so forth. But your point that this is not a U.S.-specific problem is very well taken. As you can tell from my accent, I'm from Germany, where human population densities are much, much higher and where we don't have the kind of open spaces and wild lands that the U.S. still enjoys. And I think that's why we have a real opportunity here still to protect some of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk with some other people who are listening. We have someone else over in Indiana, in Terre Haute, on our line 4. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, I have a clarification for you concerning the classified forest and wildlife programs that an earlier caller
sure.
had.
Uh-huh.
In Indiana, there are both classified forest and classified wildlife habitat programs available for landowners where you do set aside given parcels of property 15 acres or more into a classified program that lowers your tax base significantly on those properties, but does prohibit development. If you were to, for instance, change the status of that property that had been reviewed by the district wildlife biologist or the classified or by the district forester, by building or altering the landscape, you would be subject to a back penalty of interest on the difference between what you would have paid in property taxes and what you are paying, and you would then have that property removed from those classified statuses. I have 365 acres personally, of which 320 acres are in classified forest and wildlife habitat. My tax base is very low on that amount of acreage that we own.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an effort to promote the landowners of large tracts of land, 15 acres or more, to shelter those properties from development and provide wildlife habitat and future forests for our country.
Well, I appreciate you calling in and giving us the information and clarifying that point. Let me just ask you, does having the land classified mean essentially that you can't alter it in any way, or are there some things that you are allowed to do?
I trim my trees. I am able to hunt, fish, promote all kinds of wildlife enhancement programs. It's just that you cannot build structures, build roadways, or do permanent changes to the property that would affect the wildlife or the forest capacity to prosper.
I see.
And you can get further clarification, obviously, from the district, the Department of Natural Resources of Indiana or Illinois or Wisconsin or any other state concerning these programs and what their advantages are and the potential disadvantages, similar to land trust programs, where if you put your property into a land trust, donate a conservation easement, you may be curtailed permanently from doing things that your future children, your generations might want to do. So questions can, you know, they're very obviously questions that need to be answered prior to a person submitting to these programs, but the information is available from the Department of Natural Resources of the various states.
All right. Well, thank you very much for calling. We appreciate that.
Sure. Thank
all right.
you.
I don't know, Professor Radloff, you want to comment on that or react to it at all?
Sounds like a wonderful program. Thanks for the clarification, and congratulations to the listener for having enrolled much of his property in that program.
All right. We'll talk with someone else. Next caller is in Greenup. This is line 1. Hello.
Sir,
yes.
Did I hear you say hunting is not viable? And what do you mean by that, if I wanted to go deer hunting on my own land?
What I meant was is that when we put a lot of houses in an area, it becomes harder and harder to hunt in that area. Hunting in general is certainly viable, and I'm a deer hunter myself. I'm going to head up this weekend for the rifle season to northern Wisconsin to hunt. So in areas where we don't have houses, hunting is a viable management option. But if I have deer within suburban development, within a lot of houses or so, then it becomes very hard, and in many cases the DNR feels that the hunters are no longer the sufficient tool, essentially, to keep the populations in check.
Thank you.
All right. And to another caller here, Davenport, Iowa, line 2. Hello.
Yes. It's been theorized that vast areas of the plains may eventually be depopulated as a function of pumping the aquifers down out there and rendering the farmland much more marginal for agriculture. And I'm wondering, would you see this as an opportunity for land trusts or perhaps even the government to acquire large pieces of land out there and attempt to naturalize them again?
Great questions, and your point is well taken, that with the diminishing aquifers, there are problems in the future. And even now we see in the Dakotas, in Nebraska, so strong population declines in a lot of rural areas. Some people have argued something along of a bison commons or so to essentially take down the fences, reestablish prairies, and establish some large wild areas. There may be opportunities there. At the same time, of course, it's important to keep in mind with these rural communities what perspectives there are for the people living there now. But I think that is an area to take a very close look at, and I appreciate your suggestion. I think there is some real opportunity because development pressure in the plains is much, much lower than anywhere else in the country.
All right. Well, thank you.
All right. Thank you. We have time for some other callers. Let me again introduce our guest, Volker Radloff. He is assistant professor in the Department of Forest Ecology and Management at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And we are talking about what ecologists call the wildland-urban interface in the United States. This is an area where houses either come up against or are mixed up in undeveloped wild land. It is something that we in recent decades have seen more and more. More people deciding that they want to live in or near wild land. And that can create some kind of problems, very specific problems, and we've talked about them, problems for the environment, the kind of thing that really has to be managed in this whole business of balancing off the various interests here. Questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Next, we'll come back here to a local listener, Urbana, line one. Hello. So, caller there in Urbana, line one.
Oh, yes. Excuse me.
Yes, go ahead.
I was. My remarks are that you probably know that we've had wild turkeys in Urbana, and I have fed them, but we have a mayor who has called the wild animal people to come and catch the wild turkeys. And last year in January, the mailman came to me and rang my doorbell and said, "Do you have turkey tracks on your driveway?" And I said, "Yes, I know. I've been up 6 o'clock taking pictures of them." And they were two mama turkeys, females, and they were juniors about, and maybe not quite juniors, maybe first graders. But anyway, and the turkeys have roamed in Urbana, and I live near where there are quite a few trees, just off Race Street and University Downs, which has a lot of trees. I am so furious with our mayor because she sent the animal control with guns with nets in them to catch the turkeys, and heaven only knows what she had done with to them. I have no idea.
I'm going to have to jump in on you here, ma'am, because this is a story that was big in our Professor Radloff. So something was really big in our local news here for a while, where indeed in the urban areas here we had some turkeys wandering around, causing a lot of interest and consternation and conservation conversation. I guess what this points to, it's in a sense maybe related to what we've talked about, but what this points to is that there has been in areas around cities, there has been such a loss of natural habitat that animals that previously didn't come into the urban areas are doing that, and people shouldn't be surprised if they start to see deer, but also other sorts of things. Maybe, who knows, fox, coyote, wild turkeys, mm-hmm. turkey vultures, you know, all kinds of stuff that they never saw before. Now they're going to, we shouldn't be surprised to see these things in urban areas simply because as people have moved out and have built houses in previously undeveloped areas, well, what we're doing is we are disturbing or eating up their natural habitat. And so where are they going to go? If they can possibly learn to live with people and live around people, they're going to do it. So this is another sort of offshoot, perhaps, of this very thing that we're talking about.
I think it is, and you are right. Coyotes have increased in suburban areas. Urban geese is another big problem when on the golf courses. Mm. They find prime feeding grounds, but of course leave their droppings as well. And we spoke about deer earlier on, where some people are delighted to have deer in their backyards, but the neighbor is angry that they eat the shrubs and destroy the garden and the plantings or so. So these kind of conflicts are increasing throughout the country. I was not familiar with the wild turkey situation, but yeah, it is part of the problem.
Yeah, let's talk again with somebody else here, line two in Urbana. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Yes.
I just wanted to make the unpopular comment that this problem and the majority of other problems in the world today, the root of it is in population growth. And I think that until we get, you know, immigration laws and family size restrictions and things like that to control population growth, we're going to continue to have problems like this, and they're going to escalate. And, you know, nobody wants to admit to that, but I think that's the root of all these problems. And I'd like to hear anything your guest has to respond to that, and I'll listen offline.
All right. Well, I don't know. What sort of role do you think that does play in this problem?
It does play a problem. I mean, we just reached the 300 million population number for the United States, and people are talking already about the 400 million population number. So populations are going to increase, and people need houses and places to live. Population growth, or how to direct it, is, of course, a very thorny issue, and with strong moral and ethical beliefs by many people. So it's a global problem, so immigration is part of that. Population growth within the U.S. is an aspect of that. But I agree that I think a healthy discussion about what population numbers are we envisioning 20, 30 years from now would be important as part of these discussions.
Mm-hmm. Well, just we're coming down to the point where we maybe just have a couple of minutes left. You earlier talked about the fact that if we are concerned about this issue, about people deciding to live in previously wild, undeveloped areas and the impact on the environment, that's something that can be addressed on a number of issues, that the people who choose to live there can think about certain things and do certain things. We can think about zoning and about, for example, rather saying, well, okay, if there's an area where people want to live, people are just going to have to live closer together than they would otherwise like to. And then there may also be a level that you want to introduce this, address this on a federal level, looking at policy issues there. Just so, having said that, there are ways to address it, and there are a number of levels. Is this, in fact, something that is starting to be to register with the public consciousness, and something that actually people are really thinking about? That there is some sort of awareness that there is an issue here.
I think the awareness is there, and I think wildland fires have really raised that awareness, because the pictures of houses burning down are so dramatic. But a lot of people are starting to ask, well, should those houses be there in the first place if it's highly likely that they will burn down in the future? But fire is just one issue, and I'm very pleased that in this hour we had the chance to talk about a lot of the other issues as people move out into the wildland-urban interface. Overall, I think there's a positive aspect in all that, too, because it shows that people really care about wild places. It's where they want to build their house, where they want to live. So the question is how we can shape that growth, how we can shape that desire so that the damage to natural environments is minimized.
Yeah. Well, certainly, I think, as I mentioned, that it was the fire story that started us thinking about this. But and I suppose maybe we have, and perhaps we should again do something to talk about fires and fire management and fire policy. But that's, in a sense, that's an entire other mm-hmm. conversation and one where I know that there's a lot of controversy among people who deal with forest ecology about what's the best way to try to either prevent fires from starting, or then the question is, well, once you have a fire going, what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, I know that there are big arguments about which ways you deal with that and what's the best way to do it. And I don't know if there's any consensus on that at all.
Well, it's very place-specific. In certain areas, we have too many fires these days for the health of the environment. In other areas, we have not enough fires. So there is no general consensus. And as you said, it's a very highly contested problem. it is related, though, to what we talked about this hour, because with all these people moving into the wildland-urban interface, more fires will happen, and it's going to be harder for firefighters to fight those fires.
Yeah. We'll try and get one more caller here, at least. Line number two, this is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. Locally, we're dealing with the fringe of this issue, in that there's a desire to preserve woodlands and farm property. And while those are wonderful goals, the big problem comes about how to put the cost to the people that are going to benefit. And right now, the attempt is to put all of the burden on the present landowners by removing some of their rights to use their land as they would see fit. It seems to me we ought to be coming up with some way of saying, if it's desirable for all of us, then all of us ought to pay. What's your comment on that?
I agree with you. I think if open space is preserved, that benefits all of us, and as you said, all of us should contribute towards that. And conservation easements, a program like the classified forest that we spoke about earlier, they accomplish that by providing essentially tax benefit or reductions in the tax burden for a landowner. So that is one way how these costs can be transferred. But what you said is absolutely right, and I think it's an important part of the discussion, because if we just take rights away from landowners, well, the reaction is going to be protest, and nobody's going to be happy with those solutions. So that's not a good solution in the long run.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to leave it there because we have come to the end of the time. We want to thank our guest, Volker Radloff. He is assistant professor in the Department of Forest Ecology and Management at University of Wisconsin-Madison. Professor Radloff, thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much. It was really a pleasure talking with you and your guests.